Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, delivering clarity in a world of constant noise. We'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with the stories that matter. And coming up in the next 30 minutes, Afrikaans farmers meeting the ANC today over the US expropriation standoff. The global crackdown on immigration, will rich nations regret it? Green hydrogen versus the people, who really benefits? And the shifting landscape of the South African auto industry. It's Monday, the 10th of February. Now, the controversial executive order signed by US President Donald Trump, which effectively halts aid to South Africa and offers refugee status to white South African farmers, citing concerns over land expropriation and alleged discrimination, continues to cause great consternation in many circles. I want to give you another perspective today from Theo de Jager. He's an Afrikaans farmer from Limpopo and author of an open letter entitled An Open Letter to Donald Trump. And the sense I get from this letter is it'll give us a really good feeling about what farmers feel like on the ground about this whole issue. Theo, a very warm welcome to you. So let's go straight in with that question. What's the general sense in the farming community about this whole row?
Well, we are holding our hearts first and foremost because of this law that had been signed off now, because it is different to the Expropriation Act which we had and to expropriation laws across the world. Every country has expropriation laws. What makes this one different is the fact that the powers to expropriate has been expanded way beyond national government or a singular department of public works. Any department in any provincial government can also expropriate. Any municipality can expropriate. And then they have very wide powers to interpret the discount clauses in the Constitution, which means that your chance to get market-related value is very slim. Now, farmers must invest every year in their farms. There is no parking position on a farm. Either a farm is growing and expanding, or it goes backwards. And which farmer will plant orchards from which he will only harvest in 5 or 7 years if he is not certain that he will get his money back should his number come up for expropriation? That said, we never went abroad to complain that there is a big scale of expropriation without compensation. It has not happened yet. But we have seen this movie before. We went through the expropriation of Akkerland in 2018 after AfriForum leaked this list of farms to be expropriated, and Akkerland was number one on that list. So we assisted this farmer or this farming family, the Steenkamps, through their court case, and we saw exactly what the risks are in this court case. And we understand the risks involved in it. But having said that, it is not only us as white farmers or Afrikaner farmers. Let me tell you, the beneficiaries of land reform has been delivered to failure. When Minister Nkwinti said that 90% of the farms they have transferred in land reform is a failure, we know exactly why. I want to see the white farmer who can make a success under the conditions under which we expect the beneficiaries of land reform to become profitable and
Mr. Diakha, let me ask you one question then. The Akkerland issue, as far as I'm concerned, was a single isolated issue, and there is no direct threat as a result of this law that private land is going to be expropriated. Do you still live with those fears?
Of course we do, because we don't see anything in this act which prohibits government to make the to put the burden of paying for land reform on the shoulders of an individual. What would stop any radical politician in a local municipality somewhere in a rural area to try the limits of this act by expropriating a farmer?
The South African government, as you well know, is defending the Expropriation Act as a means to address historical land inequality. How do you respond to that justification?
Well, once again, the same principle. In what kind of democracy do you expect an individual to pick up the bill for a national imperative? Why must an individual farmer suffer the losses for acquiring land for land reform? The fiscus should pay for it, society as a whole. And then government says over and over, but it will happen within the ambit of the Constitution. The fact is that within the ambit of the Constitution, farmers can get hurt. The Constitution does not guarantee market-related compensation, but it does not prohibit it either. Why not just stick to market-related compensation and give the farmer who is expropriated what is due to him?
Mr. Diakha, I'm sensing a lot of disquiet and concern, even fear perhaps, among the Afrikaans farming community. What is your next move, do you think?
Well, we are sitting in a meeting right now with senior leaders in the ANC discussing possible route out of this mess, and one of it would be to change this act, and we would like to change it in two ways. Not to give that wide powers to expropriate to any municipality, and also to ensure that there is market-related compensation when it comes to expropriation, so that we can unfreeze this investment fear or fear amongst in investors.
Are you able to tell me which members of the ANC you're currently meeting with, and if you are satisfied, if you're satisfied with the response so far?
I walked out of a meeting right now, but unfortunately I cannot, if you would forgive me. The meeting was only called last night.
All right, one quick question. There are reports that are indicating over 10,000 white South African farmers have shown interest in relocating to the United States. What are you hearing? Does that figure sit well with you?
We did not get that many, but we were flooded with requests. And some of the requests come from Zimbabwean farmers. My organization, SAI, is also the biggest representative of Zimbabwean farmers who lost their land since 2000. And, you know, they say our lives and our livelihoods came to an end 25 years ago. The one farmer said to me this morning, I was 25 when we lost the farm and I'm now 50. But I feel that I still have another 15 or 20 years of farming in me. If I can have that opportunity, I'll go tomorrow. We said this year with 16,200 youngsters who we know of who will work on farms in the USA simply because those opportunities are not available to them here in South Africa. So I believe that there will be quite a number of farmers who would grab the opportunity, but most of us say we're going nowhere. Personally, if the last straw burns down here, I hope that I will still be here to try to put out that fire.
Theo Diakha, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today. I appreciate it.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, across the world, immigration is under fire. From the United Kingdom to the United States, governments are tightening restrictions, with Donald Trump once again pushing for harsher policies. But are these crackdowns sustainable or even effective? I want to give you an expert view now. Joining us is Professor Emeritus Alan Hirsch from the Nelson Mandela School of Public Governance at the University of Cape Town. Professor Hirsch, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today. We've seen a global shift towards stricter immigration laws. What do you think is currently driving this trend?
Well, I think that in some countries, including South Africa, there's been a larger influx of people than in the past. So over a relatively short period of time, a relatively large number of people have moved across borders. It's true for a few countries. But if you look at the world as a whole, the number of migrants as a percentage of the global population isn't any higher than it was after the Second World War or at the end of the 19th century. So it's not unmanageable. So I think another reason for this reaction is the fact that the middle classes and the working classes in many countries have not seen their standard of living improve for a long time after the global financial crisis and the COVID. And politicians are mobilizing them on the basis of some sort of common cause, which really isn't the main cause of their discomfort. I think that it's politically useful as well as being an issue in some countries.
I want to return to the United States in just a moment, but here in South Africa, it's common cause that we've seen a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. That's been with us for a long time. Do you think we are also perhaps more assertively starting to mirror those global trends that you've just referred to?
You know, a year or two ago, I would have said yes, because there was a white paper that came out, was passed by Cabinet in 2022, which was saying we should back out of certain provisions of the refugee treaty, international refugee treaty, and be much tougher in various ways. Even then, it wouldn't have been nearly as bad as the stance taken by Trump. I think the current government has quite a balanced approach. Now, even though some of the political parties mobilized around anti-foreigner populist slogans and had videos on TikTok and Instagram and all over the place of people marching up and down the Limpopo River, that hasn't turned out to be the policy of this government. This government, I think, they're trying to fix home affairs, which was in terrible state, fix the systems so that people can't get permits under the wrong pretenses, but also that people who are entitled to be here and that people who are entitled to get visas get those visas more quickly.
But you would agree that we need perhaps a little more preparedness in this country if there is a renewed anti-immigration stance the world over. And I wonder if we are applying our minds to that amid all the other problems that we have to deal with.
Well, I think the most important thing is that the people must believe that the government is working in their interest, that the citizens and the residents of South Africa must believe that the government is working in their interest. So if we have borders that are reasonably effective, if we have systems of visa issuing and permits and passports being issued legitimately, if the government, as it's trying to do, can show that it's protecting citizens and residents from unfair competition, then I think that's the best way to reduce the anger and that populism. I also think that our refugee policy has been very liberal and appropriately so in not forcing refugees to stay in camps. But that means that refugees and asylum seekers often live side by side with poor people who are there competing for jobs with. And we haven't made any effort to include them, to find ways to explain to the local population why they're there, and to make sure that the people who are there from other countries are legitimately there.
And how do you go about that? It's easier said than done, isn't it?
Well, you know, I think it works both ways. I think, you know, in Europe, they've had a number of initiatives. You try to basically train the people who've arrived local languages, in local customs, in to understand the country, the constitution, all those kinds of issues. And then you educate people, you know, in communities, and often this is done at the local government level. So it can be city councils bringing people together. Often churches and religious organizations can play a really significant role in bringing people together and understanding why foreigners are here and trying to ensure that there's a high level of understanding. Because very often those people who fight against foreigners don't really know them.
I want to come back to those two words you've just used, anger and populism, and the eye of the storm there is found within Donald Trump's policy, some of the harshest in recent U.S. history. You argue that policies like this won't last. What makes them unsustainable?
Well, I don't think even the people implementing think it will last. The main reason that they're unsustainable is that countries in the global north have aging populations. Now, the United States has dealt with this by allowing very high levels of legal and illegal immigration in the last few decades. But if it wants to close the door, it's going to find that the average age of the population rises very quickly and that the proportion of old people who are not working to those who are working rises very quickly. That means less production, less taxes to pay for social services and infrastructure, and conditions would deteriorate. So, in contrast, you have Prime Minister Sanchez of Spain, who is saying, you know, openly to his people, either we have a relatively open society to foreigners, or we just don't grow at all, and your standard of living will deteriorate. That is what the countries of the north face, where their fertility rate has fallen way below the rate needed to reproduce the population, and the proportion of younger people is falling fast.
Immigration, I'd suggest to you, Professor, is a dog whistle issue and is often used as a scapegoat for deeper economic and social problems. And we know what the situation is the world over right now. So looking ahead, this kind of rhetoric and often aggressive behavior is just set to continue, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is. You know, as long as the conditions of the people, you know, remain unsatisfactory. You know, some countries have housing issues, other countries have health systems that aren't working properly anymore. As long as those conditions remain, populists have a field, you know, that is fertile for simulating, for basically mobilizing. And I'm afraid that is the main challenge, is to get the kind of economic growth going, inclusive economic growth going, that will address that. And we shouldn't forget that in those same global north countries, the rate of inequality has generally risen quite significantly since the early 1980s. So that's one of the reasons why growth doesn't always benefit the middle classes. And that has to change, I think, to prevent populists from having a ripe field to cultivate.
Professor Alan Hirsch is attached to the Nelson Mandela School of Public Governance at UCT. Alan, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
I want to focus now on government's renewed commitment to renewable energy. It's a move that has been welcomed by many, but I think it's fair to say there's also a degree of skepticism. So, while the promise of green energy sounds progressive, there are others that fear that key decisions like the Bukhubai harbour development may not necessarily serve all the people that it's meant to. So let's get a perspective from Neville van Rooy, Community Outreach Coordinator at the NGO, The Green Connection, that works in communities like that. Neville, a very warm welcome to you. So you've welcomed the government's focus on renewables, but do you believe the commitment is genuine or maybe just political rhetoric?
Yeah, I know it's leaning more towards political rhetoric, in the sense that we are very much concerned. The people on the ground, the voices from the ground, are very much concerned about the narrative of the Bukhubai, especially when they, after 1994, just recently got some of their land back, and now it's being threatened by another development in the name of green, but it's not that green in the sense of Bukhubai's green hydrogen, and also the water, already stressful water area in this, and also concerns about the ocean that might be desalinated in the process as well.
Let's talk about water risk in just a moment, but green hydrogen is being promoted and quite assertively as the future. Your contention, though, is that it won't necessarily benefit people on the ground.
Yes, definitely so, because, you know, to just get that green hydrogen going, you need a lot, lots and lots of water. And you also So where is that water going to come from? One, in the already desert area of the Northern Cape. And also, when you're talking about doing it green, you want to put up a solar plant, and that solar plant is now earmarked for a very specific place where the emerging farmers of the area has got a grazing land, and that land will be taken from them. And this is our already marginalized farmers, funny workup of the Northern Cape, that is now very uneasy about this development coming to their area.
So in terms of water risk then, what specific threat does it pose to land and water resources in the Western Cape? Has that been adequately quantified, do you think?
Yeah, no, not really, you know, because when we're talking about the water risk, you know, there's already the risk that the animals need water in this area, and already where is that water going to come from? How is that water going to be, you know, used? And when you're talking about the desalination, it comes with its own risk, and people are very much uneasy about that for the Northern Cape especially. And, you know, water is already a stressful thing. We know that we hardly come out of the day zero of Cape Town. And now again, there's this industry that is so water intensively, and people are not comfortable with that going forward. We can't be comfortable about that.
So your concern then is government is not truly engaging with affected communities, and you further contend that decisions are being made without any real consultation. What needs to change, and what pressure is your organization applying in that respect?
We know we always promote the voices of the marginalized, you know, come to the people and hear what the people want, and listen to the people. That is very important. And also, we need to take the various factors in concern, especially when it comes to what type of development people want. You know, the Northern Cape is one of the world-class solar areas in the world, and why not that renewable energy potential being used and being harnessed for the benefit of all in especially the marginalized group. Now development of a harbor, a new harbor in indigenous land, where people have just recently got their land back. There's graves on the land, and there's, you know, all sorts of things that people are concerned about. And so it's important that we listen to the people about what development is suitable for that particular area going forward, because the people know the area. But this is once again a colonial, neo-colonial or oppressive system that is just pushing a certain type of development and promoting a certain type of development, and that the people on the ground does not necessarily want going forward. And that conversation needs to be an open dialogue and inclusive, especially being inclusive to involve the people, and not top-down only from the government.
Is there not a jobs benefit for the local community?
Yeah, that is the other thing. You know, when we're talking about jobs, when we analyze the jobs, there's not a lot of jobs that this industry or this type of development comes with. And that is the thing that we can't be proof. We're telling us, give us the percentage of the job. Is those jobs long-term? Is those jobs permanent? Will that jobs benefit the community? You know, when we look into the detail of that, it is minimal jobs that will be, you know, created in the process. And then that does not make sense to us why this development should be allowed then.
Just a final one. Do you not think the horse has bolted in this respect, that in spite of all the opposition that you're outlining, the green hydrogen train is now going, and it's going to be very difficult to stop it?
Yeah, we're going to try our level best. It's important that there are processes in every type of development, and those processes, we will make sure that those processes will definitely make sense for marginalized communities, and we will make sure that if those processes are harming either the environment or the people, depending on that environment, we will surely make our level best to make a stop to that or see that not happening.
How are you going to do that? Are you going to go to court?
That's a last option, but we will continue to advocate for what people want, the voices of the people. People can articulate what, like I said, their development projections that they want for their area, and we will continue to amplify those voices. And also, as a matter of the last step, we go to court as well.
Neville van Rooy, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's automotive industry is navigating a complex landscape this year. I think that's fair comment. While recent interest rate cuts are offering some optimism, there are persistent economic challenges in the country. Inflation continues to weigh on consumer confidence. I guess the entry of more Chinese automakers is also intensifying competition. We have spoken about that in depth on this program before, as well as the rise of electric vehicles present, I think, both opportunities and hurdles. So let's look into the state of the auto industry in South Africa this year. I can think of no better person to talk to than the Chief Executive Officer of Westbank, Ghanem Sibi. A very warm welcome to you. First of all, let's start on a positive note if we can. The latest car sales numbers out for January are not bad, and some cause for optimism, I think.
Yeah, so good afternoon, Jeremy, and to your listeners. So, I mean, I think a good place to start, I think the positive momentum continues from the last quarter in terms of activity in the market. We did, I think, expect that, you know, post at least two interest rate cuts, you should start to see that flow through into positive sentiment. And I think with the third one now having landed, we see that momentum continuing. So long may it last.
So the momentum is continuing. The business that you're in, the auto business, is so dependent on interest rates. Are you sensing a change in consumer behavior in the automotive market this year? Is there a little bit more confidence, perhaps a willingness even to buy up slightly?
Again, I think, you know, it's definitely very much closely linked. And I think what we have seen is we've started to see an increase in the quantum of applications forms that are coming through, but more importantly, the conversion. So effectively the take up. So, you know, customers are kind of coming through and concluding those deals. Now, the question is, you know, do we think that the change in the interest rate landscape will be adequate to kind of give us buoyancy in the market? And the answer is no. You know, so we do think that the market, albeit, will come off a low base. The growth will still be quite pedestrian. We're expecting a 3-5% uplift. And to give you an idea, that will take us kind of to 2019 levels at about 536 odd thousand from the 515 we hit last year. So if you're just kind of looking at that from a just from a kind of a 10-year run rate, you can almost see that even with a 3-5% recovery, we still go to the lowest point in the decade. So which is not necessarily exciting, but I think it's good. We'll take any recovery we get.
I'm sure you will. Are you able to give me a sense of the type or the size of vehicle that people are considering these days as you look at those applications that are coming through your system?
Yeah, so I can give you an idea. I mean, I think where we've kind of seen massive interest has been in the Chinese brands. But I suppose let's just maybe largely say the Asian, which includes some of the Indian brands, but the Chinese have definitely stuck out. We've seen definitely that the price point 500,000 and below has definitely been a lot more of an interesting point. This is specifically in the new vehicle segment. In the used kind of segment, we've also seen brands like Suzuki definitely leading new and used. We've seen brands like kind of the Cherries of this world and the GWMs definitely starting to leapfrog in the top five. But we've also seen that coming off massive strain with the traditional players as we've known them.
So where does this leave the top end of the market then? You know, maybe between sort of 800,000 and 1.2 million.
I think that market is going to remain a lot more subdued. I think we have seen that customers who play above that 900,000 mark have definitely reflected more of a buy down trend over the last kind of 2 years. And we think that that trend kind of continues. However, having said that, you know, we are also seeing that there is a change in the amount of investment that the manufacturers are putting onto their products to try and rebate pricing to stimulate demand. So, you know, I think we do see a potential comeback through different product structures such as guaranteed future values in that segment of the market. But on the back of traditional installment sale, we think that continues to take a bit of a beating into the foreseeable future.
Of course, it's not just the auto manufacturers themselves, but it's also the long tail. We've seen a decline in manufacturing activity for a third consecutive month. Ghana, that is concerning, obviously, and this downturn is going to have a broader impact on the entire automotive value chain.
100%. I mean, I think that that spans even into the export market, right? So I think there is still a number of structural items that still have to go through to be able to stimulate GDP, to be able to stimulate the required level of activity for kind of a full bounce back. Unfortunately, some of the noises that we are also seeing playing out in the media recently, you know, kind of US and the tensions that are coming through aren't necessarily boding well. But having said that, I think one has to equally be holistic in their approach to equally acknowledge that there has been a bounce back subsequent to the, you know, the GNU being formed. I think, you know, if one sits and looks at where we were last year this time, not only from a sentiment perspective, but even from a flows perspective, I think that was all kind of southward facing. So, you know, we did see some recovery. I agree that it's not necessarily enough to be able to get us out of the required slump. You know, if one looks at population growth net of inflation, but I think it definitely is some positive, a spin-off that is coming and probably not coming quick enough, but at the very least, I think leading in the right direction.
Do you have a view as to why electric vehicles are not being adopted with the speed in this country than they are globally?
So I think there are a number of factors, and I think we have to be fair to ourselves in the sense that I think our regulatory regime was not necessarily as favorable as most developed markets in terms of retail sales of electric vehicles. So the pricing has definitely been significantly higher for customers than in most developed markets. There has not been rebates. Secondly, we did come through a period where I think power generation was under massive constraints. So I think that coupled with the Eskom issues has meant that there was a lot more concern around whether those vehicles would be able to be charged when they needed to. So there was a lot of anxiety as far as that's concerned. Thirdly, I do think that the products which were sent down south from the developed markets were more expensive than, you know, what our customers could afford. So you could not necessarily scale those. So I think it kind of touches back on the question you had earlier around principal values, that those kind of products were on the high end and meant that only a smaller percentage could be able to get into those vehicles. Having said that, I think if we look at what's happening again across the developed markets, where there has been a withdrawal of subsidies, we've seen that there's been a downward trend in activity in those markets. I think it is quite interesting as to exactly what that right balance will be in terms of what real demand looks like outside of stimulus, but secondly, how tradable those vehicles will be in the used car market. And I think some of the signs we've seen in some of these markets has been that, you know, people are still trying to find themselves, but it is actually kind of reflecting a reversal in activity in EVs.
Just before I let you go, let me slip one more in, Ghana MCB. Obviously, you have a specific type of financing model in your particular business, but we are seeing alternative ownership models, vehicle subscriptions, usage-based services. They are emerging the world over. Is this something that might find traction in this country, and how much of a threat would that be to your business model?
So the honest response is I think it has to find traction. And I've gone on record for a number of years to say unless it does find traction quite quickly, the market will continue to be under pressure because vehicle price inflation has and will continue to outpace growth in real disposable income. So I think that's a critical point to understand. So we have already started to venture into those types of products. We are doubling with a number of pay-for-usage products, albeit not at scale. If the question is, if that were to be, you know, scaled by a competitor tomorrow, how much trouble would we be in? I think we'd be able to respond. We have already established networks, and I think we continue to be quite aggressive in terms of making sure that that becomes a bigger chunk in our product mix. Appreciating, though, that that is a completely different business model in that we have to carry different risks associated with the asset. But I think quite simplistically, in as far as the SA market is concerned, we cannot be able to push up our overall numbers without getting these alternatives and of course, creating new markets.
And that is a look at the automotive industry in 2025. My thanks to Ghana Msebi, Chief Executive Officer of Westbank. And that's also our program for today. We're back tomorrow with another fast-paced 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.